Welcome to Cultural Fugazi, an optimistic take on the culture of the end times. I'm your host, Chris, and I'm joined with my co-host, Justice.
That's me. I'm here also. It's true.
Excellent. Justice, what are we talking about today?
So today we are going to do our second part on class and class dynamics and how they're interpreted in some movies that we like or movies that we've watched. All movies are good movies. Brett, they're good dogs. And today we're going to be talking about Knives Out 1. Well, Knives Out and Glass Onion.
A Knives Out mystery?
A Knives Out mystery. Yeah, I was like, a Knives Out tale.
Yes. A Knight's Tale.
A Knight's
but
Tale.
But with knives.
But with knives. Isn't that also... Anyway. So this is an extension of our class conversation that we started on May Day. Great news. We're recording these things back to back. So if you liked us a little toasty off some wine, don't worry. I poured us some gin and sodas. So we're going to be talking kind of about how these movies work and deal with class. And Chris, I believe you've stormed up a thesis right quick.
Yeah, indeed. So our thesis for today is both Knives Out movies use setting and character to comment on wealth and class, though the first movie manages to do so more effectively.
Chris, I like it. I like it so much that we're going to do our new segment, returning from last time, which is ask the robot what the thesis statement should be. So I asked the robot to tell me how Knives Out 1 and 2 talk about class dynamics.
Okay.
And it said, both Knives Out and Knives Out 2 are sharp and witty films that offer a scathing critique of class inequity. The films are both entertaining and thought-provoking, and they provide a unique perspective on a complex issue. I need the robot to take a side eventually. It did this before on, I think I asked it the first time of like, hey, how do I did some trial runs.
Yes.
And I swear to God, I need this thing to fucking have an opinion.
I do love how it's just like, yes, the thing that you asked me about is in the movies and the movies are about the thing.
Well, it does. I will tell you this. It does go into more detail. I didn't read the rest of it. Mm. It does say things like, you know, the Thrombies and Marta are, you know, against each other, and the Thrombies are a wealthy family of...
Okay.
So, yeah, it's seen the movies, Chris. It also has a fucking Netflix account. So we'll be talking through both of these films. If you haven't watched these films, you can find them on your streaming platforms of choice. And what I mean by that is Knives Out's not on streaming.
No, so because licensing is weird, Lionsgate is still a little salty that their cash cow got taken from them by Netflix. So they've been real weird about streaming it anywhere.
You think they would sell it to someone else to be like, fuck you, Netflix. It's on HBO. It's on Peacock now, where things go to die.
Well, but this is the... Hey, let's just hop into talking about capitalism immediately. This is the way that media works now, is that companies use streaming rights to have weird proxy wars with each other.
This is fascinating because we're on the precipice of a writer's strike.
Yeah, yeah.
At the time of recording, and we don't know how that's going to play out as of May 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this conversation gets even fucking weirder later. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, no. They absolutely play proxy wars. They form their own militant Twitter groups to go in and harass everyone. Peacock doesn't have a militant Twitter group, I would assume. No one's a Peacockian.
Nah, that's weird. Look, even we both love Psych.
Yeah. And
even that movie is like, no one watches Peacock.
It's true. But then again, there are the Netflix faithful.
Yes.
The Netflix baptized.
Yes.
They're the Hulu hooligans. right? Like, Apple has their...
Oh, absolutely.
Their weirdos.
Yeah.
You know, Peacock doesn't fucking have any, but no one's there preaching the gospel of a peacock. Right?
No, although I say that, and Waypoint Radio, rest in peace, they recently, like, I believe went off on like a tangent about how Peacock is actually one of the better streaming services because they've got a bunch of good stuff, which actually, like, you can get Nope, Ryan Johnson's other project that we mentioned in the last episode, Poker Face.
Oh, yeah.
That's on Peacock.
It's Secret Good.
Yeah.
Secret Good. Yeah. Who knew?
Oh, no, I've started it. Oh, no.
Oh, no, it's us. We're the Peacockians.
Oh, no.
Anyway, we're going to talk about Knives Out 1 and 2. Don't know where to find Knives Out 1. I rented it. Knives Out 2 is on Netflix. You can't search Knives Out 2. I don't even think you can search Knives Out. It does show up, but like...
Yeah, so if you search Knives Out on Netflix, it will give you Glass Onion.
I did that, but it also like recommended like two other fucking things I didn't want to watch.
Oh yeah, it will give you a bunch of weird spy movies, some of which are Netflix originals that you've never heard of.
I would assume so,
because
right?
They're bad.
Yeah, that's how that shit works.
Yeah.
Anyway, you can tell we've been drinking. So, let's get into it a little bit. We'll start with Knives Out the first.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll start with Glass Onion, the baby of Knives Out. I think there's a couple things to start with right away. Obviously, these movies are in conversation with each other. This is a pretty easy double feature to pick out. I don't think these movies are the best at talking to one another, which I find surprising. The threads that link them, I think, are kind of weak. So this is fascinating to get into what I think is one of the better movies of that year to start with, which is the first Knives Out film.
Yes. I have some hunches about why we might see the more tenuous threads, but we'll get into them, I think, more when we get to Knives Out 2.
Yeah.
Which is not Knives Out 2.
Which is, yeah, not Knives Out 2. It is...
Glass Onion.
Yeah, a Glass Onion. I'm going to think of more dumb fucking things as we go on. So, Knives Out 1 is a murder mystery wrapped in a murder mystery wrapped in a murder mystery. And what I mean by that is the movie is about everyone's favorite topic to write about, a writer, right? Everyone who writes things loves to write about writers. It is a family. It's about a family who the patriarch is a successful mystery author. He's a Patterson-esque, King-esque, empire-driving author.
Yes, Harlan Thrombey.
Yes, it's the
Thrombeys.
Yes, of all of the Thrombeys.
Yes. And, you know, Harlan, I assume, you know, a nod to Harlan Ellison. When I hear the name Harlan, that does give me writer vibes.
And his family. And on his 85th birthday, he is found dead the next morning of an apparent suicide. And the only person who knows what happened is the nurse.
Marta.
Who is treated like family. So... To kind of make this conversation happen a little bit quicker, we're not going to explain all of Knives Out. If you haven't seen it by now, please go watch it. This is your opportunity. I will give you a 5-second break to go watch the entire film and come back.
Yeah, and we'll say there will be spoilers, although we might not get nearly as in the weeds as we do with some other movies. Right. So, still.
So, yeah, so here's your 5-second break. One. And... you've seen Knives Out. If 5 seconds-ish. I said, all right, it's not an exact science. So Marta is obviously... the movie does a lot of really good, subtle situations with what it would be like to live in this type of scenario. She is a... younger Hispanic nurse. She lives at home with her mother and sister. She doesn't have her own place. And she works for a wealthy family. We don't know if all of that wealth is inherent or if, you know, we have a strong writer who was able to provide for his family in the long term. And we're kind of introduced to the family as we're starting to figure out what the actual mystery is. We have the eldest daughter, the two sons.
Yes.
The daughter-in-law and all their kids.
Yes.
Right, there's two sons or one?
So two sons, and there were three, but one passed
away. Right. Yes. So we find out a couple things that everyone's... Is there two sons or is there one?
Anyway, no, there's one son.
Yeah,
there's
one son. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the husband of...
Thinking of the husband of the... Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so we're introduced to the entire family. Kind of everyone has their own motivations of why they would want this 85-year-old man dead. And he kind of knows that. You know, the son who's around is running the publishing business, but won't let them do things like sell the rights of the books to Netflix, which is funny because the next movie's on Netflix. The eldest daughter is...
Well, she has her own business, and...
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, we are given the sense that of the family, she is probably the one who is actually making money currently to some degree. Everyone else seems like they are very much just, like, riding off of the coattails of Harlan and Harlan's wealth. Even her business, the seed money, very much came from him.
Right. Yeah. She started this business on her own with $1 million loan from her father.
Yes.
Right. They, you know, she has a son whose name is Ransom,
mm-hmm.
which, if you're going to name a kid something.
Hugh Ransom.
Yeah, Hugh Ransom.
But only the help calls him Hugh.
The daughter-in-law, her daughter, who's in college, who plays a very particular role as the film goes on with, like, we start early into getting into some of the politics of what the film wants to say. We mm-hmm. do that right off the bat, knowing that this is a family gathering. It sets it up in the same way that you would expect everyone talking about Thanksgiving, you know, how Thanksgiving dinner goes at your family is, you know, the racist uncle gets drunk and starts yelling about the damn liberals and the immigrants, right? So we do that pretty quick once we get into the actual murder mystery, which is our patriarch is dead. The cops are there to interview. We have we just talked about him in
Lakeith Stanfield.
Yeah, Lakeith Stanfield. We just talked about him in Sorry to Bother You. He's here as he's the lieutenant.
Yes.
For the police. Then we have a state trooper who's helping him out.
Yes.
Who's the golden retriever of the group.
Very into mystery novels. Very excited to be at Harlan Thrombey's estate.
Yeah, no, he's just happy to be there. Yeah. And then we have LeBlanc, right?
Yes.
I always forget LeBlanc.
Benoit,
that's right. I'm not using enough Southern. Benoit LeBlanc, played by Daniel Craig. He's there.
Oh, Benoit Blanc.
I keep thinking LeBlanc, but he's not from New Orleans.
No. We don't think.
We don't think. It's hard to tell.
That accent is.
It's hard to place him.
It's something.
We do eventually get to, like I said, we're introduced to the rest of the family, but mostly we're introduced to everyone. They sit behind that beautiful chair that's in all the movie posters and all that shit.
It's
that
the
has
chair of knives.
The chair of knives. And everyone sits in that chair and gets interviewed by the cops, and they all tell their side of the story of, you know, they saw dad and what happened that night. We don't really get super far into the class dynamics of the film until we really spend a lot more time with Marta, because everyone's like rich. Everyone's rich, but I would not call them wealthy.
Mm.
Or they're wealthy, but they're not like it's tough. I don't know.
Well, yeah. So I think the thing that you're seeing here is that very sort of like nepotistic wealth that it it is a wealth that it's fascinating because I think you have a family that is play acting at old wealth, at being old money, who very much is not old money, but they have procured this house up in somewhere in New England and are really attempting to play up the sort of like, oh, we're an established family. And so like the beginning of the movie does not give you a ton of information that would lead you to believe that they're not an established family necessarily. So you're presented with these people who are giving you the version of themselves that is, we're rich, we've been around, our father is this very important person, we're upset that he's gone. Definitely attempting to paint a picture of them in a very particular way.
Yeah, and I think that's the part where, you know, they're broke without their dad in the picture, right? And without his inheritance.
Yes.
I think that's the thing to really... The eldest sister is not... really quick, let's run down more of this cast right quick, because I think it's kind of critical to realize how good everyone is in this. We already talked earlier that we have Daniel Craig as Benoit. Chris Evans is Ransom. Ana de Armas is Marta. Jamie Lee Curtis is the eldest daughter, Linda. Michael Shannon as Walt, the youngest son. Don Johnson as Linda's husband.
Toni Collette is the widow.
Yep, yep. Lakeith Stanfield, again, we can't say enough. Catherine Langford as the daughter, the youngest daughter of the, or the daughter of the widowed...
Of Joni.
Of Joni. Yeah.
Or Toni Collette. Toni and Joni. Look at that.
Toni and Joni. Look at that. Jaden Martell as Jacob, who is the right-wing alt-troll, who is cotton master. Like, the whole thing with him is, man. Again, if you want to, we get into it, it's good. It's Christopher Plummer as Harlan Thrombey. Ricky Lindhorn, again, everyone else is kind of there. I'm trying to think if there's anyone who's... Frank Oz is in it. He's a delight.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of really it from like who's important in the movie and kind of what that cast is. It's a fun cast.
Yes.
That's a good group to put together to make a fun movie. And we'll see that done, I think, even better in the sequel. If you wanted to be like, what's a good cast that you would put together to do this type of thing? I think whenever you're making a second film in what you decide is now a franchise, I think they did a better job the second time of that ensemble cast. Really feels like an ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like a good murder mystery cast.
Yes.
And everyone in it is a delight. But yeah, let's get into more of the details here. So, you know, the Thrombeys, Harlan is 85. He has just updated his will a week ago because he's decided he's cleaning house right before his 85th birthday. He's going to start cutting off the money valve for everyone. He's going to wrap everything up. Everyone's going to have to start surviving on their own or be independent. And that's kind of the theme of his 85th birthday is he's walking around telling everyone, you know, fuck you. You're going to have to figure out your own shit. And it goes about as well as you would expect. Everyone, you know, now that he's dead and they think they're getting their inheritance, they're all, you know, no one speaks ill of the dead. So they're all, you know, the first time they go through the interviewing, everyone's very, you know, well, I was close to dad. And, you know, we had a good conversation that night about what the business would be. And then you see the reality of the situation as they're explaining it. We don't really do the who's lying, who's telling the truth. We see the lie as it happens.
Yeah.
And we build out to the point that we can see that the only person that that he really trusts, Mr. Thrombey,
Harlan,
God damn it. Who Harlan really trusts is his nurse.
Yes.
And that's kind of the only person that he really has a real relationship with.
Yeah, we get to see him have conversations about the decisions that he's making with his family, with her. And the interesting thing there is that, like, she is very clearly there to listen and be a sounding board and to, like, she's a nurse. She's providing care. She is not there. Like, she's not invested in this situation. And in many cases is like, I'm uncomfortable that you're going to do this thing to your family because she's got a big heart and she doesn't like to see people have to struggle. And, you know, Harlan's like, no, but I think this is the right thing to do. And uses that sort of relationship as a sounding board to work through his decision to ultimately cut people off. And, like, basically be able to have the support from her of, like, I know this is going to be difficult for you because I know that, like, I know that you are upset about the way that this has all turned out. He feels responsible for people not making their way in the world. He feels responsible for them not really understanding what their wealth means, not really, like, recognizing that, you know, the wealth, feeling like it's something they're owed rather than something that they have worked for. And he feels like he hasn't done enough to foster a spirit of them feeling that sense of, oh no, I did this.
And I will say, we kind of establish the politics of every individual very quickly too, with specifically their relationship with Marta. She's used primarily as our focal point whenever the family gets back together for this last detective interview before they just wrapped up the funeral. Marta wasn't invited, but everyone thinks she's part of the family. But everyone else was outvoted of whether or not she should be there.
Everyone makes it a point to tell her, you know, I thought you should have been there, but I was outvoted.
Which you can't be outvoted by. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. So you can tell already what some of the specific systems at play are. But I think more critically, we kind of see that, like I said, everyone kind of gets together and we show the birthday party and everyone's kind of drunk and shitty and they start arguing about politics. And again, it's that idea of, well, of course, anytime family gets together, all they do is get drunk and shitty and argue about politics. And it's wild to not live in a family that's one of those, but we just get drunk and hang out. You know, they do that thing.
Yes.
Right? The young 16-year-old alt-right troll doesn't participate because he's too busy looking at his phone and, like, checking Twitter and being a shithead on Twitter. Yeah, Tony's daughter, mm-hmm. right? Comes out and, like, immediately hugs Marta and is like, hey, you know, how is everything? And seems to be a confidant a little bit with Marta, or at least seems to care about her as an individual. She's going to school. She requires her grandfather to pay for school or she doesn't get to go.
Yes. A couple of people, I think, in that scene make it a point to suggest that, oh, Meg, you're getting one of those silly liberal arts degrees. What is it even in women's studies? It's like you said, it's the politics are made clear. Yeah, Rian Johnson uses some shortcuts here.
Yeah.
He's like, hey.
Sorry, her name is Meg. Sorry, I fucked that up. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, it's like, hey, you know what this means.
Yeah, like, so yeah, we are short. Everyone's a stereotype.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of critical because the movie cares about that stuff because it makes a point to have those discussions because it wants it to feel like a scenario that you have to make some decisions about, which eventually is that the will was eventually updated such that Marta, after, you know, he cuts everyone off and he goes through and he says, you know, we're going to move on, which, again, the eldest daughter has the least amount to lose, kind
right.
of,
yeah.
Out of that, but she still wants the house.
Yeah. She is, in some ways, the most vocally like, you won't do this to us.
Right. And she has the least going on, or at least appears to have the least going on as the film has everything set up. But, Marta gets the entire inheritance.
Yeah.
Which becomes an issue because she's not a part of the family. And the whole point of, like, the entire family, the entire time, they kept telling her that she's a part of the family and we're going to make sure that you're financially taken care of. And the family has decided that you'll be financially taken care of once we all get the inheritance that we'll set some money aside for you. You know, you've been a great friend to our father.
Yes.
So she gets all the money and spins that entire narrative upside down with the rest of the family, where, you know, eventually they say things like, well, you're going to need to hire a good fucking lawyer to keep your illegal immigrant mother in the country.
Yeah. Once the announcement is made, the alt-right troll calls her an anchor baby. Everyone is swearing at her. They literally go from, in one scene, like you said, saying you're part of the family, we're going to take care of you, to without even asking what's happening here, just immediately, drop of a hat, you have stolen this thing that is ours. It's our birthright. You are a monster, and we are going to come after you.
It's a, I think that thing is well done, where we have a universal truth, which is, despite your individual politics, you know, this is a wealthy white family, and despite everyone's individual politics, they all fall into the same fucking trap, which is, this is mine, and we gave it to who?
Right.
And what's your claim here? And, and that's kind of the only, I think that's the reason why we spend so much time dealing with that at the beginning of the film.
Yeah. Well, and you have a situation where, like, I think it is important to note, and I have to assume that Rian Johnson is aware of this. I think a lot of us at this point are aware of this. A lot of wealth gets captured through inheritance in America. Like, at this point, one of the primary ways to be wealthy is to inherit your wealth from your family. And so Harlan Thrombey creating this empire and being the one who builds this wealth, and then basically, like, his children get to be the rich ones after that without having to do anything for it and feeling entitled to that, is very much reflective of a very common American experience of, hey, my parents were rich, and so now I'm rich, and so now we're rich forever. But the thing is that the will reading, as you mentioned before, flips that on its head. Suddenly we go from, you just get the wealth, your parents did it, so now you're in the club, to now this immigrant who ostensibly is not supposed to be in the club is the one who is going to inherit everything.
We know, as the detectiving continues to happen, detecting, I guess that would be it. As they continue to detect, that our detectives are not super competent either. So we have the world's greatest detective,
Benoit Blanc,
who seems kind of like an idiot throughout the film. Like, he kind of seems like a buffoon almost, with his over Southern drawl. You can lay it on thick, but,
and he keeps saying phrases that sound like, oh, this is like Southern wisdom, but you hear them and you're like, that doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
This is like, the truth bends towards gravity's rainbow. Like, what?
Thank you.
That doesn't mean anything.
Thank you for, that was pretty good.
Oh, thank you.
I don't have that. I don't have that in me. They do, they literally in the film do call his accent, what's the Looney Tunes rooster?
Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah, they do literally call him, you foghorn leghorn sounding motherfucker or something.
Yes. CSI KFC.
Yep, CSI KFC. Yeah. And I wonder if that was done after they heard Daniel Craig's accent. They were like, hey, we gotta update some of the lines in this script. Like, we gotta let him know that this sounds like shit. Like, it's good. And it seems like everyone had a fun time.
Yeah.
Like, and it seems like a delight. But yeah, eventually, everyone, you know, all of the detectives kind of don't have a great idea of what's happening, because it's seems pretty reasonable. He eventually slit his own throat, and that's the end of it. And the only thing they're kind of waiting on is a toxicology report, right? So how would this be anything else other than a regular murder or a regular suicide.
Suicide, yeah.
Yeah. The one thing that I think kind of throws me for a red herring is eventually whenever he's talking about Ransom, who I don't know if we said this earlier, is played by Chris Evans.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Yeah, and the best white sweater. We all know this. This was several years ago.
It's a wonderful, chunky knit. It's like a Fair Isles, just cream, white, yeah. Heavy.
You could have found it. Like, it was like $250. Like, right after the movie came out, they're like, here it is. Mm-hmm.
Get it from Scotland if you can.
Yeah. But Harlan had said this about... Ransom is that he could not tell a prop dagger from a real one. So it's kind of interesting. Like, I found that interesting that he eventually slits his own throat with a dagger, and then Ransom grabs a dagger later off the chair of daggers. And
mm-hmm.
Are they all prop daggers? Like, the whole thing later turns into a how much of this would he know would go exactly this way? Did he have a good idea that the meds would have been switched?
Mm.
Is that why he threw the meds? You know, obviously that's why he threw the meds on the floor in the first place, is that he had a good idea that the meds should have been switched. You know, so how much of this did he actually know was happening the entire time it was happening?
Mm.
Which I would say most of it, in the way that movie would like you to think. So Harlan has a really good idea the entire time of what's going to happen. Blanc is there on a random invitation.
Yes.
You know, he was not called in for this. He was invited to do this
anonymously. Yes.
Which you know, eventually turns out, hey, Ransom was trying to set Marta up so that he had an idea that she was going to get the inheritance, so he wanted to set her up so that she wouldn't get the inheritance. He figures out that she still would get the inheritance because he slit his own throat. Therefore, he works with her to kind of still get his end of the inheritance once he figures that out, and then still also tries to, he eventually gets blackmailed. It turns into a whole thing. It's an actual mystery.
Yeah. Ultimately, his whole thing is, I need us to go back to the old version of the will. And the way to do that is to get Marta implicated in Harlan's death. And so he's got an original plan that does not go as intended, but then there is a backup plan that he attempts to execute, and it starts to work until it doesn't.
And I think the critical component of that is that Ransom is set up like he was Harlan's writing assistant.
Yes.
He spent time working on murder mysteries with his grandfather, and knows some of the tools of the trade. And we're told by Harlan how Marta can get away with murder.
Yeah.
Which he's like, I need you to, if I only have 10 minutes to live, I need you to do this and this and this and this and this. And he's right. Cause she does eventually get away with what she thinks is murder.
Mm-hmm.
Then we eventually find out that, hey, she's not responsible for his death. She just happened to think she was. He slit his own throat. Is that because he knew what was happening or thought he was going to die either way? I think the movie set you up to think that he was going to do that anyway. eventually, you know, they find out that it was, you know, Ransom tried to set her up and actually did end up killing someone in the process of trying to set her back up.
Yes. Well, and attempted murder, regardless.
Yep.
And then actual
and
murder.
Then actual murder.
And then another attempted murder.
And then another attempted murder. There are some really good class dynamics. Like I said, there was the situation where the younger brother shows up, Walt, right? Walt's the...
Yes.
Yeah. We're throwing names out, hoping we're right. But yeah. I believe I'm right on that.
Absolutely, you are correct.
Yep. Shows up to Marta's house and is like, look...
This is after the announcement. Yeah, this after is
after
she's
the after
everything.
The will.
Important context: her sister and her mother are undocumented.
Yep. And he goes, "You need to give us back the inheritance.
It's the right thing to do.
It's the right thing to do, and we'll help keep your family in place because otherwise we're going to report your family.
Yeah, heavily and, implied. He's like, yeah. Look, not saying that anyone in the family would do this, but...
But now that you have all this likely, media scrutiny...
Exactly.
It would likely come out... The news vans are outside
yes.
whenever this gets announced.
Yes.
That the random nurse has all the inheritance.
Yes.
And, you know, really implies that she needs to have the family's help to have the means to hire good lawyers. And she does eventually go, you mean all the money that I have
mm-hmm.
to hire good lawyers?
Like, so I could just, I could just hire those lawyers?
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the more powerful scenes of like what that dynamic flipping on its head actually means. And that's when you really get it.
Well, I think one of the important aspects of that scene is you have Walt shows up assuming that he has the power yeah. in that scenario, and that part of the reason that he has the power is because he just assumes, well, I'm the white man who should get the money, and so I can show up to this person's home and tell her, well, you're going to get deported, so like, I know I've got the power here.
I have the moral high ground, yes. and you're committing an illegal act.
Yes.
Therefore, yes. you should listen to me.
Well, and largely the thing that he is saying is, on the hierarchy, I want you to be aware that I'm higher than you, and so my word means more, so you should be careful what you do. And what she says is, no. This is not about your position. You have told me that this is about the money. And if I have the money, then it doesn't matter that you are rich white Walt Thromby. Right. I can just go get those lawyers. Right. So it really pushes against that idea that, oh, Walt has the power in that scene, because he definitely shows up thinking that he does, and then ends up very much not.
Anything else that you would like to add for the first Knives Out film?
So, I mean, I think we've alluded to this, but the treatment of Marta, and you know, we have multiple scenes where literally every single Thromby suggests that she's from a different country.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. That yes. she's from Uruguay.
Yeah, Ecuador.
Ecuador.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone ever says Mexico.
No. So, like, they to highlight that they clearly have not paid it. Like, she is a background character to their lives. She is a set piece to them. And I think one of the things that really highlights is that, and the Walt scene does this as well, any nice thing that they are doing for her is, to them, a reflection of how good they are, and not actually. And it's very much like this is noblesse oblige. We are the noble rich folks who are looking after the poor unfortunate souls who cannot look after themselves. So like, I think it is important to note that the family feels like they are in that role and does not recognize Marta as an actual person, does not really know anything about her, suggest that they care about her when it suits them, and that switch flips immediately when they think it doesn't.
We only really get to explore that because so much is taken away from those, or so much of their expectations yes. are averted or changed based on you know, what their father eventually does. And also there's a really cool murder mystery in there, right? It's fun.
Yeah.
That movie's a fun ride. That also kind of dabbles in this space. I think it plays its politics well.
Yes.
I don't know, and I think we'll get into this more with Knives Out 2, ultimately how effective it is with its messaging. I think it's more effective. We'll get into this later, but I think it's more effective than the second movie. Yeah. It at least, I think, accomplishes its goal, and I think yeah. it accomplishes its goal really well. That this wealthy group of white people could eventually not understand, not know why, have a, you know, and not figure out, you know, what's actually happening to them. and those that do and can eventually would try to exploit that. So,
yeah. So I think as a bit of a transition, I think that the first movie, the way that it is framed, you get, you know, a very... The movie feels like it's New England-y. It feels like it is like... And again, we know that the characters are not old money, but it feels old money. And the way it's shot, the way that those characters act, the way that things are framed, even the lighting gives you that, like, it's a little bit musty. It's a little bit, you've got greens, you've got darker browns.
You can smell those rooms.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is fog happening in this.
Yeah.
So, like, it is setting a visual, like, metaphor that gives you a sense of, like, who these characters are and gives you a sense of the way the money works. And it's a bit muted. It's a bit understated, but also, like, trying to be overstated. But, like, there's that push and, like, the Kennedy's Camelot, like, that kind of feel.
Right.
The second movie is not understated at all, does not approach...
Again, we're gonna throw this in the washing machine with bleach.
Yes.
And everything's going to be sparkling and clean.
Yes.
And with that, we're going to move on to the second movie. But before that, we'll be right back.
And we're back, and now I think we can discuss the spectacle that is Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery.
Yeah, Knives Out 2 Electric Boogaloo is a entirely, like I said, it's the bleach blonde tips to the undercurrent that is the first film. And Rian Johnson kind of does one thing again, which is he sets up all of these stereotypical people and their specific politics. And mm-hmm. we start the movie with that, with all of this very diverse group. They're not family anymore, right? We know, hey, we've done the arguing over Thanksgiving dinner family.
Mm-hmm.
Your racist uncle gets drunk, whatever. We've done that thing. We're moving on to that, to all of your friends from fucking college.
Yes.
And some of those people are shitheads. You're all shitheads. Everyone's a shithead. part of that specific type of life. So the found family, they're all friends. I'm doing friends in air quotes. And they're all people in different parts of influencing circles that are all friends with a Elon Musk-esque character.
Yes.
The Elon Musk character is played by Edward Norton. The Twitch InfoWars-esque hyper right. They lead into... It's played by Batista.
Yeah.
They lead into him with, like, I'm not saying I hate boobs.
Yes.
Which when I feel like I
when
feel
I
like
talk I about ju- the when I talk about the boobification of America,
right?
What I mean is
I don't hate boobs. It's so good. We also have I'm gonna let you introduce the rest of the cast because you have the iPad open.
Yeah. So Janelle Monáe. Who is playing both Cassandra and Helen Brand. Madeline Klein is Whiskey. Leslie Odom Jr. is Lionel Toussaint, which mm-hmm. with the beard, I did not recognize him. When I saw the credits at the end, I was like, oh, that was Leslie Odom Jr.
Oh, that's nice.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And then Catherine Hahn, of course, as Claire DiBella, our senator.
Yeah.
Our governor, rather.
Governor. Yeah, our governor. And
running for Senate.
And is that not a role that she's already done?
I mean, no, but also, yes.
Yeah. Like, everyone's kind of someone else that they've been in another movie.
Yeah.
We have Birdie, who is played by
Kate Hudson.
Yep. And is that our big group of the what do they call themselves? The Disruptors.
The Disruptors.
Yeah, which is a fancy word for shithead, which the Thank movie you, gets Helen. Into. So they're all middle class America-esque.
Oh, also Hugh Grant, who I think might be Benoit Blanc's boyfriend.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's kind of made not specifically clear, but
yeah,
clear.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And Benoit Blanc is back. The singular tying thread to these yes. two movies. And kind of their idea of compromised political stances in the face of overwhelming wealth, right? Like, both of these movies are about wealth. And money, and getting access to money.
Yes.
So, yeah. Blanc is back. This movie takes place in May of 2020.
Yes.
And, because it's like, we're in the thick of, hey, lockdown is lasting longer than we thought it would. And
yes. When we first meet Benoit Blanc, he's in a bathtub being very sad about not being able to do cases because the world is locked down.
He's literally playing Among Us over Zoom with
Natasha Lyonne, Angela Lansbury. The other one is Stephen Sondheim.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And
yeah,
I'm sorry, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. My yeah, God. I was going to say.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I was right.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit, was I just like, it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, one of our greatest mystery writers right now.
Who's also very politically active.
But yeah. And they're just playing Among Us in the bathtub.
Yeah.
Which, getting back to like early 2020 pandemic days of like, do you just want to play? And then they were like, do you just want to play Fibbage or something or Code Words or one of the Jackbox games or whatever? And he's hanging out in the bathtub, smoking a cigar, being a COVID person. And it kind of gets to everyone. Everyone's kind of dealing with this, and they're all different types of influencers. So we have the actress who's throwing a party with 80 people there, but they're all in my pod. And we have the governor who like realizes that she opened the delivery door, but the delivery driver's wearing a mask, etc. Like, it's that very much no one knows what the fuck to do era of the pandemic, which we haven't, we're not living in a point in time yet where we have a lot of films set during that era of the pandemic. Or at least none that I can think of.
Right.
So they all get the package from the Elon Musk-esque character, and it's an invitation to his private island in Greece, or off of Greece, that they're all going to show up to and do their annual yearly vacation. And this is the same year they have just betrayed their friend. They were all friends, you know, post-college. They were all in their 30s, going nowhere. They had just betrayed one of the inner circle. We have one of these inner circles. We do. And we have a rule. We do.
We do. This is true. This is true.
And they betrayed one of the group by saying she did not help their Elon Musk character help found their Facebook equivalent, which is not a good Elon Musk metaphor, but...
Well, so the company is called Alpha, and I don't know that I would necessarily say Facebook equivalent because, you know, it is Elon Musk's, X company because they're developing energy...
Eventually, but it sounds like Alpha sounds so close to Meta that, like...
Had Meta changed its name by then?
But he also comes in one of those conversations wearing a Steve Jobs outfit too.
Like, he does. He's
trying to kind of ride all of it, right? Like,
well, and I think there's maybe some commentary about how all of these terrible billionaires are the same because yep. they are.
Yeah. And so they go to their friend, not Elon Musk's private.
Miles Braun.
Miles Braun.
Yes.
And they go to his private island where he sent all the help away. And it's just going to be them hanging out, being cool. But yet this is after they had just forced
Cassandra.
Cassandra.
Played by Janelle Monáe.
Yep. Out of the business of their tech empire. Testified in court that
the idea was Miles's.
Yeah.
He's responsible for the whole thing.
He built it all himself, and she was always a partner. So she gets cut out, her life gets ruined. He takes everything, and she shows up to go on the island, and then also Blanc's there.
Yeah.
He shows up.
Surprise.
Yeah. He said, I got an anonymous invitation. And so they all go to the island with the world's greatest detective because the theme for their get-together is going to be a murder mystery.
Murder mystery. So, of course, Benoit Blanc's there.
Yeah. They get to the island. Everyone goes, why the fuck is Benoit Blanc there? And then eventually the Elon Musk character is, why the fuck are you here? Yeah. And he goes, well, I don't know. And that's part of I've received an anonymous invitation. I got to figure out who invited me here and what's actually going on. But, you know, whatever. We're introduced to several key concepts. One of those is that there's a new hydrogen style of energy that's going to change the world. That he never leaves anywhere without his car. So he put his car on the roof because mm-hmm. there's no place to drive it. And also that there is a weird hippie that floats around the entire time, whose name might as well be Red Herring.
Yeah. Well, in the spirit of the name of the movie, Glass Onion, where it's just as obvious as you think it is, Miles Brown literally at the beginning when they land on the island is like, he doesn't mean anything. He's not important. And he literally doesn't mean anything.
He doesn't mean anything.
He is not important.
Yeah, the film kind of really, the film so much lives up to its name that it eventually tells you multiple times that this is a glass onion and that the mystery, the most obvious answer is the right answer.
Yeah, it's like, don't overthink it.
Yeah.
We literally, the title is, should just be don't overthink it.
Don't overthink it. And that's how most murder mysteries are. Don't overthink it. It's usually the husband. Right, like it's usually who you think it is.
Unless it's Scooby-Doo.
But, you know, Blanc is reeling from not having a good mystery.
Yes.
So he's trying to figure out, you know, what's actually happening here. There's a reveal in this movie, like there is in the last movie, of what's actually happening here. And what's actually happening in this new Knives Out movie, Attack of the Clones, is that... Because it is that Cassandra, Andy, right? Andy?
Yes.
Was Andy. Murdered.
Yes.
Before the trip kicks off.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knows except for her twin sister. She hasn't announced it to the press.
And the killer.
And the killer. So she goes and finds Blanc and says, hey, I want you to go to this island that we have an invite for. And help me find out who killed my sister, my twin sister. And he goes, I think the best way to do that is if you come too, dressed as your sister and pretend to be your sister the whole time. And she does that by putting on her white man voice. concept we've explored earlier this month.
She does say...
she calls it rich bitch.
I was going to say, my sister... suddenly shows up talking like a rich bitch, and she's got this rich bitch voice because they are from Tennessee, I think it is.
I thought it was Georgia, but maybe you're right.
Yeah, they're poor Southern family.
And the story was my sister and I used to talk all fancy like about who spoiled the caviar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we would call that the rich bitch voice. And then one day she shows up and I hear her on a TED talk and she's doing the rich bitch voice.
Yes.
And so she's going to put on the rich bitch voice for the entire weekend to go hang out with her sister's friends. Now, Chris, I had the benefit of being a twin.
Yes.
And I find this scenario incredibly unlikely.
So this is not like when we were talking about Sorry to Bother You, where the call center scenario was spot on.
Yeah.
This is the opposite of that.
This is the opposite of that. Okay. That people seem to somehow think like twins are magically able to be the same person. Like all she does is read her sister's journals because she kept a journal every day.
But there were just two.
Yeah, I know. She must do bullet journaling or something. Like she must have a system.
This is a little bit of a, I had a bit of a problem with that, but that's not important.
Yeah. Yeah. So like as a twin, that ain't how this do. So found that kind of a stretch, a lot more stretches here. And I get it. Like you're trying to build a very specific thing, but there's a lot of stretches. The entire hinge of the mystery turns into while they're on the island, Batista's character is murdered and it's out of the cup that has Miles's name on it. Right. And that's, and so maybe someone's trying to kill Miles, but, Batista's, which also, I think this is with, come back to me. Hold on. I know this shit.
Can you provide any details?
Yeah, I don't want to because I don't want to.
Okay.
Because I should know this.
Okay.
Blade Runner. Fucking Blade Runner 2049. Excuse me. Yeah, a film I definitely fucking know. Batista also dies in that film.
He does at the very beginning. And surprisingly good performance for only being in the movie for like 5 minutes.
And this is where I was wondering too, like, is Batista's drama catalog? And I would call this more of a drama than a comedy.
Hmm. Interesting.
A little bit. I would say it's a murder mystery is more of a drama than a comedy.
This is a murder mystery, but
yeah, I know. But the other one was.
Yeah, the other one, 100%. Yes.
But anyway, if Batista's entire drama quote end quote catalog is going to be dying in films.
Honestly, I hope not, because I think he's got some chops.
Yeah, no, he's been great in everything. And I think he does a really good job of playing a shithead. Like, great in this. So he dies and everyone's trying to figure out, well, was someone trying to kill Miles? Was someone trying to kill him? Turns out someone was trying to kill him. And the entire point is that her sister died before she got there, so she plays her sister. And that's like they're trying. So then she's shot, which turns out she survives by dumb luck.
Because she has one journal can stop a bullet.
That's not how journals work.
Or bullets. Either of those things. Unless it did not look like a low caliber gun, and I admit I don't know a ton about guns.
Nope.
But that didn't look like a .22.
No, that's definitely supposed to be a .45.
Okay.
It might be a 9 disguised as a .45, but it's supposed to be a .45. So there's like, I would have accepted like, hey, she dropped because she panicked and then she like the bullet missed. I would have accepted that as a way to like explain her surviving, like go take the billionaire's incompetence to another level. Eventually we'll find out that, hey, it's a glass onion, that the most obvious answer to who's been trying to solve this problem is the billionaire. Right. Yeah. And the actual thing is that he's stupid.
Right. Well, and I do have to point out, and like the first time I watched this movie, because this was my second watch of this movie.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
No, I mean, I think there's a for me, there's enough in this movie that's fun that it was fine rewatching it. Like, now that being said, I will on purpose rewatch the first Knives Out. Just for fun. This movie, I'm not going to come back to again on purpose. If there's a reason, sure. But that being said, the first time I watched this movie, and the movie is blatant about a lot of what it's doing. The way that the murder happens is like it. They show you the murder. Like they show you very blatantly the murder. The murder happens, and I remember watching it and being like, "Wait a second, no." He just handed him that glass.
Yeah.
It was the billionaire.
I was watching that movie with someone else and they also went, "No, that's weird that he just handed him the glass." Yes. And then he just lies like, "No, I saw how that went the first time," and then now they're showing it again different. And I think to use that as the mystery to try to be like, what if you see the thing? And everyone sees the thing, and then I just lie about it.
Yes.
That was fine. I don't know. Like,
So I think to start to get to some of our thesis here, I think what we see happening here is that the movie starts to crumble under the weight of what the message that Rian Johnson seems to want to tell about Miles Braun, a.k.a. Elon Musk, which is, this is a stupid man who does stupid things and he can't do anything right. And so we get a subpar mystery because it is a mystery enacted by an idiot.
And that's what Blanc tells us that, right?
Absolutely. He says, did love that.
Yeah.
That was maybe the best part of the movie.
Right. Is that he literally goes on the rampage of, you're an idiot. This is obvious.
Yeah, you start like, I assumed you must be smart because everyone says you're smart.
So there's steps in here about global warming.
Yes.
We deal with that concept because the governor who's running for Senate is running on a global warming platform that...
courting the leftists.
Yep, courting leftists and all this, that, and the other. And that we're also dealing with the politics of the ultra-right. Batista's character is charged with selling rhino boner pills to children.
Courting the manosphere.
Yeah, courting the manosphere. We have a yes man. We have some casual adultery. It's just a... The characters aren't as fun. They're bigger archetypes, and I think that the casting, and this is what I wanted to get to, I think the casting for this movie is actually a more fun cast.
Yes.
If you were to lock me with a bunch of actors in a room, I bet you this would be the room of actors whenever the pandemic, I think they started filming this right after the pandemic started or whatever, like slightly further out from that. But yeah, like they seemed like they had a great time. And according to all the interviews, it seemed like they had a great time. This seems like a more fun cast, and I just wish they were in a better movie.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I think to that point, that's part of the reason why I did not mind rewatching this movie, because the movie, I don't think the movie manages to land what it's attempting to do, but I do really like all of these people. And getting to watch, having an excuse to revisit the performances that they make in the, because the individual performances have moments where they're, and frankly, like Bautista's character, there are a ton of moments that are perfect. That just, like, mwah, good work. You did it. You nailed it. And like, I think Janelle Monáe does a fantastic, I think a lot of these characters do a really nice job of, like, landing parts of the movie. The problem is that it doesn't coalesce nicely, and part of the reason that it doesn't is that, in my opinion, is that the movie wants to make a commentary about absurdly rich people who do not have their riches because they have earned it. They are actually fools. It's the emperor with no clothes, and so let us expose the emperor. And the movie is attempting to do that. And the thing is that, like, yeah, but you have these fun characters, and, like, you could have them, like, being involved in a cool mystery, and instead, we're talking about Elon Musk. And we talked about this a bit before recording. I think that's something that's easier to get away with in a world before Elon Musk has purchased Twitter.
And in 2021,
yes,
that's a stronger commentary than 2023.
Yes.
Which is, we have seen the wheels fall off.
Yes. Because at that point, there are still credible humans who are saying, no, this man is a genius. You all need to calm down.
There were people who I know who were very intelligent still buying, like, still praising Teslas.
Yes.
And
yes.
Teslas had not, the propaganda machine had not yet changed on Teslas like it is today.
Yes.
You would know, you drive an electric car and you don't drive a Tesla.
No.
Yeah. Now in 2023, it doesn't, knowing that that movie is set so much in 2020, I think actually helps it because
yes.
It helps sell that idea of the time and place that you're supposed to be in, which is we have a guy naming the drone ships after one of my favorite fucking book series of all fucking time.
Yeah.
But it turns out that dude's a dick and an idiot.
Yeah.
And it's just like, just because I've read the culture books too. And just because I've read the culture books does not mean I am qualified to fucking launch a rocket into space. But I just happen to be too broke to make that a reality for me.
Mm-hmm.
Where Elon Musk is not.
Right. And I think at this point we are confronted with that almost every day. And back when this movie was released, we were not yet in a space where Elon Musk is doing something phenomenally stupid almost daily.
He had just started.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
That was right whenever the relationship with Grimes stuff was like they were having the kid and they named the kid whatever.
Yes. XA.
Yeah.
And like, spy plane.
Hey, be happy. Right.
Like, sure.
Do what you got to do to be happy. Just don't. Don't be an idiot. and the entire point of the film,
frankly,
is like,
honestly,
hey,
like,
being rich is not smart. Like,
yeah, like, be an idiot, but if you're gonna be an idiot, don't be an idiot in a way that is going to impact millions of people.
So any last thoughts about Knives Out 2 or Knives Out 1 and kind of their thoughts on class? Any closing arguments?
Well, so I think that Knives Out 2 attempts to present a character of rich people that involves, like, your billionaire creating the glass onion. And it is attempting to use an aesthetic that is over the top in order to sell that notion. And I think you see a stark contrast between Knives Out 1, which gets to use that, like, understated New England aesthetic to tell its story. And I think particularly when we have been just assaulted with dumb rich person antics of Elon Musk daily and seeing the glass onion unravel before our eyes just constantly, it's much easier to be able to appreciate and to, like, enjoy a story that's talking about kind of crappy old New England rich people versus a story that's talking about kind of crappy Silicon Valley rich idiots. But either way, I think that in both cases, the movies do attempt to let you know that, hey, there are people have been impacted who do not have money. Like, Helen is from a poor southern state. Her sister...
She's a teacher.
She's a teacher, yeah. Her sister, like, rises to fame and makes money through that startup culture and then is, again, we talked about this in our last podcast, destroyed by the machine. The machine goes, no, you don't get the dream. Bad news. We've eaten you up. We're spitting you out now. And so, like, I do think that the movie presents that effectively, but it gets overshadowed by this comical presentation of your Elon Musk character. While it's accurate, yes, we know. We're painfully aware.
I wish that was more fun.
Yeah.
And I think that the challenge is that we're now so deep in it. We're farther than knee deep. we're at chest height with bullshit from that specific category that it wants to riff in satire.
Yeah.
That it has to say something new.
Yeah.
And even at the time that it was finally released, that was a little stale.
Yeah.
And I would say that its end message is going to be one that I think is going to be challenging to have hold up. In a way that I think the first film doesn't. The first film's easy to have hold up. I think that stuff works really well.
Well, and I think part of the way that that works is that the first film centers Marta. It really makes her the focus of the story. And so the Thrombies are there and being terrible, but they're never where our lens is going to, like, yeah, they're not our primary point of view. In Glass Onion, Helen is never our focus. Andy's never our focus. Our focus is kind of the Braun character. It's the Elon Musk.
It's him, and then it's also Blanc.
Yeah.
And I think the reveal into of, hey, Blanc and Helen are in it together.
Mm-hmm.
That's less fun than whenever we find out that Marta is actually at risk for this thing.
Yes.
And that is a greater, that's a more fun challenge for us as a viewer than what they do with Helen and Andy. I think Blanc almost does a reverse of the first film of like, hey, we're going to show up and try to do this thing together.
Yes.
Like how it was done in the other thing. And it's just less fun to do.
Well, again, we have not, we don't care. And like, I really love Janelle Monáe, but like, we don't care about that character in the same way we care about Marta. Marta has been made a person, and we are invested in her story from the beginning. And so when things get weird, we're concerned for her, and we're hoping that Blanc is going to like help her out because we care about her. With Janelle Monáe, we have not been given the opportunity to care about those characters in the same way. And like, Johnson tries to shortcut that by saying, hey, teacher, it's from a poor, it's poor upbringing. It's very sad. It's like, no, you haven't. You need to actually give us time with that character to really form that bond that's going to make that interaction between her and Blanc work the same way it did when Marta was our Janelle Monáe.
I think the challenge with the second movie is that's the mystery.
Yeah.
And that's the reveal, right? Yeah. Is that she's a different person than who she says she is.
Yes.
And then it shows us the same scenes that we've seen earlier from that secondary perspective, and then it happens too late.
Yeah.
She's not a full person. We're dealing with someone else. We're dealing it from the other character's point of views, and they're not relatable. They're not likable.
Mm-hmm.
And that by the time we finally turn that page and shift focus, that it's kind of too late for us to latch on and really do that ride again.
Yes.
Because it's like, what if you did the same thing, but now it's this side? And it's just not, it's a less fun experience.
Yes.
I didn't hate watching it. I thought that reveal was neat.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the minute I turned my brain back on to any of what happened after the fact, I was like, this is less good.
Yeah, it's a movie that it's like, oh, this is a fun time. But once you're done with it, you're like, I'm good.
Yep.
Versus the first movie where it's like, oh, that was great.
They should make another one of these. And you know what? I think they should make another one of those.
Yeah.
Well,
we're going to get a third, so.
Hopefully it's another one of those.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see.
All right. Lightning round. The scene where Blanc comes into the pool in the second Knives Out film is obviously a direct parallel to whenever he enters the swimming pool as James Bond in substantially less clothing. Chris, pick an outfit. Blanc's outfit into the pool or James Bond?
Blanc.
Now, Blanc's outfit or Batista's outfit.
Oh boy. Okay, so
because Batista is a direct parallel to the Bond thing, except yes. he's actually wearing the gun.
Yes. So that's harder. I'm still going Blanc because it's so delightful. But
what if you had a Speedo and a gun?
Yes.
A gun bigger than the Speedo.
Yes.
And I think that's what's critical. The car that's on the roof. Does it make any fucking sense? Like, I get it. Like, it's an eccentric billionaire joke, and like it's relevant to the mystery. But like, meh.
It's, and I think this is part of the problem. Wanted to make I launched my car into space joke, and so that's okay. what we get.
Okay.
And all it does is confirm
that
what
the budget,
we already know,
that the budget was too big for the second movie and they had too much CGI work to do.
Well, and that like Rian Johnson wanted to make sure you were painfully aware that we're talking about Elon Musk. It's like, no, you've made it obvious. You didn't have to do that too. We were already there.
Yeah. Great. Well, that will do it for another episode of Cultural Fugazi. I forgot to mention this last time, but you can email us, us@fugazipod.com, and let us know what you think about Batista's outfit and whether or not you would pick the Speedo or the full top and bottom.
Yeah, do you want to be a Southern gentleman? Or
wear a bikini.
With a gun.
With a gun. So that's the choice is yours. Thanks, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks.